Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, let me start off with a couple of minor programming notes so that I don't get, you know, we don't get sued for false advertisement or whatnot. This is Damn You Hollywood. I am Robert Winfrey, and I know all the material promoting this says it's going to be myself and Mark Radulich tonight reviewing this movie. I will be reviewing King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. But that's not going to happen. Mark let me know about 5 minutes ago. He's just really, really under the weather today. So he's temporarily tapping out, and I don't blame him. If there's one thing that's not going to help nausea, it's talking about this movie in many respects. So Mark is indisposed. Hope he recovers as fast as is reasonable. And you've just got me tonight. That's it. And I know like 80% of you just switched off the podcast. That's fine. I can live with that. But it was scheduled and what the hell, I'm going through with it. I've talked to myself for an hour plus it stretches before, and I am not afraid to do it again. Tonight on the chopping block, Guy Ritchie's take on the Arthurian legend. Again, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. This movie almost didn't get reviewed because it was just, it was positioned as kind of a blockbuster, but there's just so little, there was so little hype, there was so little positive buzz, but this is one of those that's kind of on me. You know, there's some that Mark insists, yes, Robert, you will review, you know, the Smurfs and you will like it. And I stab another pin into my voodoo doll of Mark. And then there's ones that I kind of go, no, this one. You know, I did X, Y, and Z. You're going to do A, B, and C. And, I mean, in addition to all the, you know, crappy ones that I'm stuck doing anyway, like Transformers. Ugh. Now, this is one that I wanted on the schedule. And I wanted it on the schedule because primarily there's a couple of things here. One, I'm just a fan of Arthurian lore in general. I first read The Once and Future King when I was like 12 or 13. I really wish I hadn't because I don't think I got everything out of it that I could have, and I haven't reread it. I've read other takes on it. I've seen several movies, not every cinematic or even television adaptation, but certainly a significant chunk of them. And it's just kind of a universe that I'm both familiar with and attached to. So I like Charlie Hunnam as an actor. And I really wish he'd been given better material in this instance because he can act, but ugh. And we'll get into that when we talk a little bit about the money, because I've looked up some of the production issues with this film. So I'm going to talk briefly about that. That's kind of why I put it on the schedule. You know, I mean, Guy Ritchie's hit and miss, but, you know, he's got a good reputation, and I was interested to see his take on it, and there was nothing else this week. It was just kind of a confluence of events. So that's kind of what led us to this point. Like, I feel so bad for Mark, because he not only had to see this thing on, like, Friday was when he saw it, but now, you know, he's too sick to actually get on here and yell about it. So he just suffered twice, needlessly. I mean, it's unfortunate. All right, this is your last warning about spoilers. I am about to do, you know, the old plot synopsis here. So for anyone else out there who hasn't seen this movie but is familiar with, again, kind of the Arthur legend, there's some significant deviations, which are not inherently a bad thing. I'll talk about that in general. But if you... just as a warning, if you hear me talk about certain characters and you kind of go, no, that's not where they are in the, you know, essentially, you know, the source material, that's by design. I promise you, I'm not misspeaking about pretty much any of this. All right. This movie opens with a assault by the leader or the most powerful. That's never quite made clear. A mage of significant power by the name of Mordred, who's attacking Camelot, where Uther, played by Eric Bana, and his brother Vortigern are, you know, trying to hold him off. With the power of the magical sword Excalibur, Uther kills Mordred, sends his, you know, magical giant elephants packing. Seriously, giant, huge. Like the elephants in Lord of the Rings were, like, you know, small, right? Huge elephants. Anyway, defeats him, gets ready for another bit of peace, but by this point, Vortigern, played by Jude Law, decides he wants the throne because, I mean, look, can I be, I don't want to do, you know, Mark's not here to yell at me about this, so I will very briefly discuss one of my issues with this trope. It's a little tiresome, you know, the younger brother gets jealous of the older brother who's king and wants to usurp the throne. I mean, it happened plenty of times throughout history. It's a trope for a reason. I just say I wish they'd gone a little bit different way with it. Anyway, which he does. He sacrifices his wife to gain enough power to defeat his brother in single combat. His wife dies. Little baby, toddler, you know, 3-4-year-old Arthur, is sent off down the river in a basket. Unfortunately, Vortigern cannot completely... seize control of, you know, the realm of England because he was the sword Excalibur is bound to the bloodline of Uther. So as long as one of his direct descendants, in this case Arthur, is still alive, it won't work magically for anyone else. He loses that. He loses Arthur. He still becomes king and, you know, spends the next several years further solidifying his despot status. Well, Arthur floats all the way down the river to Londinium, where he is adopted at a brothel. We get a really nice sequence of... nice might be a bit of a... Guy Ritchie has a very odd pacing style to his movies, and it kind of shows here. We get a big sequence of flash-forwards where we see Arthur growing up. The salient point comes a little bit later when Arthur... runs afoul of some Vikings, deals some physical damage. These Vikings are actually, they've got diplomatic immunity, so to speak. They're there at the behest of the king, who is trying to shore up his rule. And now, you know, the king, that, you know, he doesn't like his honored guests being harassed, so people come out, so they go looking for Arthur. Arthur is picked up by a different group of these, what do they call them, blacklegs? I don't know, the kingsmen, the enforcers, the army. Because as this is going on, A significant portion of the sea level drops right around Camelot, revealing Excalibur now embedded in rock. Which you come to find out is the petrified remains of Uther in the sequence that is never properly explained. Like much in this movie. And now trying to figure to find this, you know, the lost son. It is Arthur. Vortigern has every young man of approximately the right age rounded up, brought to Camelot, and they'd get to try to pull the sword from the stone. Because if you're not his son, it won't work. And then you get a brand that says you've been tested. You get a nice drink, and then you get returned to your home. It's something everyone has to do. So to avoid being arrested for assaulting diplomatically immune Vikings, he goes on through that trial, pulls the sword from the stone. Everyone kind of, no one expects it. I mean, there's like hundreds of people have tried this, if not thousands, and it just never works, but it does in this instance. Pulls the sword from the stone, passes out because he can't handle the power that comes with the magical blade. Vortigern decides to publicly execute him. Because, again, you can't have... At this point, you know, there's some myths, some, you know, just urban legends and whatnot that have started spreading about Arthur, the rightful king, the born king, returning to reclaim the throne, yada, and you don't kill someone like that quietly in an alley. You do it publicly so that the myth dies with them. Makes sense. As he's about to do this, Arthur is rescued by the remnants of his father's knights, Jimin Hansu, playing, who was it? Bedivere, I think. Then there's a mage whose name is never given. I swear she's not given a name. Yeah, no, she's just the mage. Good grief. I just think that's lazy. Anyway, they rescue him. They want to, you know, incorporate him into the resistance movement. He's reluctant. He doesn't want any of this. But, you know, Vortigern has torched his home. He's murdered some of his adopted family. Now, you know, his back's up, and he's got no other options. So he joins the resistance. He tries to, they set up an assassination attempt also in Londinium, which is the best parts of this movie occur in that location. That's just Ritchie's style is predisposed to succeed in that location, in that setting. More so than some of the more epic sequences, which he tends to fast forward through, which is both interesting and frustrating as a viewer. Anyway, so they set up an assassination attempt. Doesn't work. Arthur loses a couple of friends. But as he starts tapping into the power of Excalibur, he winds up deciding that the best way to do this is to storm through the front gates. He loses a couple of his friends, his street crew. He tries to throw the sword away. Again, he doesn't want this. He was only doing this under duress. The Lady of the Lake shows him a vision of what will happen if he doesn't, and it's not pretty. So he kind of decides, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're charging after them. They wind up doing so. Vortigern kidnaps a couple of his compatriots, forces him to deliver the sword, then come there alone. He gets a magic... This one's never fully explained either, and this one bothers me. He is... The mage sets up an enormous snake to ambush the throne room where they're going to kill Arthur after he surrenders. I mean, and the snake is huge. And it's never explained. How it got there, other elements of it, it's magic, kind of go along with it, but a degree of explanation would be nice, not, you know, serpent ex machina. Anyway, Vortigern winds up sacrificing his daughter to get the same amount of power used to defeat Uther, but Arthur is significantly more skilled and a little bit angrier. He defeats him. England becomes united, sort of, and... we end with a cheering populace. The major kind of... I kind of skipped over a bit where he is... Every time he grabs a hold of the sword, he gets a vision. Every time he grabs hold of it with two hands, and as irreverent as it is, I just couldn't get that bit from the Wolverine out of my head. You know, Japanese sword requires two hands. Well, apparently so does the English sword. Anyway, he gets visions of, you know, the night his parents were murdered, which he doesn't remember a whole lot to begin with. He thinks they're just nightmares. He, you know, slowly kind of comes to the realization that they're memories, and finally uses a bit of that as inspiration to overcome Bortigan's quasi-demonic form in their final fight. Again, he kind of joins, kind of unites significant elements of England. He introduces the Round Table, and we're supposed to be set up for a sequel. That's not a joke. I believe I heard there was supposed to be like a 5 or a 6 movie franchise coming out of this. That ain't happening. Again, we'll get to that in a bit. All right. And I imagine I skipped over a few parts there, but bear with me here. The movie succeeds on a few levels. One, anything that happens in, again, Londinium is... Guy Ritchie tends to succeed in when he can, you know, fast-paced, fast-talking urban environments. If you look at the Sherlock Holmes movies he directed, that's where they're at their best. Stuff like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. One other one he did that I was going to cite here. Rock and Roller, that's the other one. I mean, these are all... That's where he primarily is, in that situation. When he can, you know, again, a lot of fast talk, a lot of fast cuts, again, urban environments, that's his wheelhouse. And if he's in that situation, he does okay. It's actually part of the reason I'm a little bit excited, well, both excited and leery about him directing the live-action Aladdin movie in a couple of years. I mean, it's in pre-production now. It'll be released in 19, I think, is the release date they've set, tentatively. Because Aladdin's a fast-talking street hustler. I mean, again, this is... That's Guy Ritchie 101. How we'll deal with more of the fantastical elements. That's where I'm a little bit leery, but he's not a bad fit for that one, for that movie. If you look at the movies he does that don't do as well, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Revolver, primarily those are the kind of primary examples. I haven't seen Swept Away, so I can't comment. That's where, when he has to get outside of that, when he has to deal with more action-driven. I mean, both the Sherlock Holmes movies are not action-driven. They feature a lot of action sequences, but one of the reasons they're successful is they're Sherlock Holmes stories, and so there's a lot of paying attention, intelligent dialogue, interpersonal relationships, things of that nature. Here, anytime this movie deviates from Arthur in the streets kind of being, you know, a local street boss, anytime we get away from that or that environment, the movie suffers. The big, sprawling, epic parts of this movie are just not things he's... I don't want to say things he's not equipped to handle, because I think that's passing too much judgment on the man, but it's not where he really excels. That's not what he's good at. And this particular movie called for a fair amount of not being in that location, as you know, and when it's not there, again, the movie kind of suffers a bit. There's a shocking lack of character development for most of the characters. Arthur gets a bit of an arc, but even that is somewhat stymied by some poor choices in some of its pacing, some of it is elements of the writing. It's just not moments that are supposed to have a lot of emotional heft to them. The first time he gets the full memory back about, well, essentially the full memory of what happened to his parents. Looking at when he sees the vision of the future and has to wind up accepting that, no, you're the only one who can do this. Again, the couple of his friends who die, Hunnam can emote. Charlie Hunnam's a very good actor. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work in the greater narrative sense. It's not a knock on his acting. Again, it's narrative structure, maybe things that got left on the editing floor. It's also a huge byproduct of, again, production issues. This thing was rewritten multiple times, was reshot towards the end. It's what ballooned the budget. And again, when we get to the money, I'll talk about that. So it's a very uneven movie, partially because of the change in locales and styles away from what Ritchie really excels at, and partially because a lot of people had their hands in this over the years, and anytime you do that, what you wind up with is always muddled. Always. I mean, even the ones that can succeed on a lot of levels, like Ant-Man. Ant-Man was amazingly, bipolar. Very, very obviously, okay, this was written by Edgar Wright, this was written by the other guy, this was directed by Edgar Wright, this was directed by the other guy. If you're familiar with Wright's style and sensibilities, it becomes very obvious very quickly what he did and what other people did. And there's a bit of that here. You can tell where Ritchie really excels and where he tries to make the movie as awesome. And where, because of either conflicting visions or budgetary concerns or all kinds of things, he's stuck with trying to do someone else's vision. The other thing that really bothers me a bit about this one is the lack of the interpersonal dynamics. Some of them work okay. Arthur and the two main guys that he kind of brings along with him, I forget their names. They're weird names. So my apologies there. But the two of his crew that come with him on most of this adventure, and one of whom dies, the interplay there works okay, that you get the sense of, you get a little bit of the camaraderie there. And even in the others who he's not supposed to be buddy-buddy with, there's some tension between him and the guy they call Goose Fat, because he always escapes. There's some tension there. There's some tension with him and Bedivere, but it never really translates that well. And Jimin Hansu's a very good actor. So I have to put this down to writing primarily, because I've seen Ritchie direct circumstances like this in a better fashion. I've seen all of these gentlemen act in circumstances of rough equivalence in a better fashion. So it comes down to the writing in this case, and maybe a bit on the direction, but I'm primarily blaming the script in a lot of respects here. I mean, the one thing, not the only thing, but the best thing about the, I think it was 2004 King Arthur movie, it stars Clive Owen, I think it was directed by Antoine Fuqua. Don't hold me to that one, but I think that's who directed it. There's a lot of problems with that movie. One, it completely eschews magic and mysticism. It tries to be a historical... It tries to be historically accurate type thing is kind of the basis for that movie. And Clive Owen's a fine actor. But there's just a lot of problems with it. The best thing about that movie is actually the knights and their interplay between each other. Among them, Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen, which I got a laugh out of when I rewatched it after I was watching the television series Hannibal and realized, because I knew Mikkelsen was in it, I'd forgotten that Hugh Dancy was as well. But yeah, those two, in the television show Hannibal, they play Will Graham and actually Hannibal Lecter, respectively, to Dancy and Mikkelsen. But they shared some screen time. They shared a lot of screen time and inter-character play in that movie. And the camaraderie there amongst those characters in that movie is the best thing about that movie. And that's one of Fuqua's strong points primarily. Is I hate to say it this way because it sounds weird, but the male dynamic, the way a group of men just will interact and give each other grief and he gets that on a very profound level in some respects and translates it very well to the screen. In this instance, there's not a lot of that. There's not a whole lot of the way these people relate to each other is not translated all that well as a viewer. The other thing that kind of kills me about this movie, Jude Law as the primary antagonist. Again, Jude Law's a fine actor. And there's moments in this movie, again, particularly where he sacrifices his wife and daughter in separate intervals, but he is required to sacrifice the blood of a loved one to gain the power he needs. Good job acting with just his face in those scenes. It's not a lot of dialogue from him. It's a lot of just physical acting. And you get a real sense of, you know, regret, remorse, I don't want to do this. Unfortunately, it seems uneven because the rest of the time he's not a scene-chewing villain, but he's a rather unrepentant bastard the rest of the time, which is fine if you want to go that way. That's okay. But it makes it feel uneven for him to then have these big emotional moments. You need to intersperse that more a little bit. There needs to be a bit more to that than just, again, almost, you know, again, bipolar. You know, one or zero, as far as that goes. Jeff is informing me that the characters I'm referencing from Arthur, the ones he brings with him, are Backlack and Wetstick. Thank you, Jeff. Much appreciated. So again, I really wish that they would have developed Vortigern as a character beyond another take on Claudius from Hamlet, which is all he is, basically, and poor written. Because he has the chops to pull it off, and he is able to display that, but it just feels uneven because it seems to come out of left field. I mean, it felt almost... How do I say this? The fact that he had to sacrifice the blood of a loved one almost seems like an afterthought in the script, that as they were writing it and then shooting it, they realized, oh, he has to actually express some kind of affection and remorse for this person when he kills them. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And just rather than retune elements throughout the movie to make that a cohesive character bit, it's just kind of slapped on there. And it's a credit to Jude Law that he makes those moments feel as... as powerful as they do. And again, I'm not talking like, you know, people in the theater are breaking down sobbing, but this is clearly something that actually affects him. And all that's in it, so, you know, that's a bit of an issue. Again, the mage character, I read this in Jeff's review, and I want to reiterate it. The mage character serves almost no purpose other than to bring magic into this fold, because Vortigern is developing magical powers. You need magic to counter magic. And I never understood the necessity in this film in particular. They almost try to force a bit of a romantic relationship between Arthur and the mage. And it never gets beyond like superficial flirting, mostly on Arthur's part. The mage is uninterested. I almost wish they just left it out. It's so utterly unnecessary. These two could have had a very interesting relationship if, you know, you've got Arthur, who's, again, kind of a fast talker, bit of a street guy, against this almost socially awkward character. I mean, that is, it's well-tread comedic territory, but this movie does, you know, step into that from time to time, which is fine. But it almost feels like that relationship should have been based more around that rather than trying to bring in, you know, a quasi-romantic element. It just feels out of place, and I'm a little bit over the notion that every movie must have at least the inklings of a romantic subplot to it. In some cases, it works out quite well, and that's fine, but it's not a it is not a requirement. This is not carved in stone here. Your movie, I don't know, maybe the studio executives do. Maybe they have their own secret form of the Ten Commandments, and one of them is thou shalt have a romantic subplot. I mean, that's all I can assume at this point, because it really wasn't necessary. Some of the action in this movie is good. There's a couple of chase scenes through the streets of Londinium that are really nice. There's one battle sequence that I thought was good. I'm trying to remember which one. Because it wasn't the final one. Wasn't the one in London. Yeah, Londinium becomes London. So forgive me, I'm going to refer to it as such. It'll come to me later. I don't want to think too hard about it. Again, there were a couple that were good. A lot of the... Oh, I remember. Before he really gets Excalibur going in London, there's a really kind of fun fight between them and between a lot of his guys and some of the... Vortigern's men, some of the army. But a lot of it just gets lost in bad CGI. The entire final battle between him and... I don't even know. I'm just going to call Vortigern a Dark Souls boss at that point. Because... And even some of the Dark Souls bosses are so much easier to read and follow visually than that character was. It was a mess. The 3D element to this, I didn't see it in 3D, but this is one of those movies where you can absolutely tell what's meant to have the 3D effect and what isn't. That doesn't do it any favors. And a lot of the action is cut too quickly. The camera focus is either too close, is, you know, a little bit too narrow. And as a result, the color palette in this movie is in many places a bit of an issue. It's so hard. It's unnecessarily dark, and a lot of it just kind of bleeds together, especially when we're doing, again, a lot of the faster paced stuff where you have to be able to visually index what's going on screen. If everything's the same, you know, muddy brown to gray, it becomes difficult to read. I mean, actually, the sequence where the water drops and winds up revealing Excalibur, for something as simple as that, it's a withdrawn landscape shot, and the sea level just drops like 4 to 5 feet, which is a terrible thing, by the way. But and it's needlessly difficult to read visually because everything's the same not exactly the same color, but everything's so close to each other in terms of shading and just the overall kind of color palette that it's needlessly difficult to process visually. And that becomes even more apparent when we get into fast-paced action sequences that are done with, again, mostly CGI'd stuff that... And again, I don't know about you guys. My threshold for CGI is different from a lot of people's. I have a very low tolerance for CGI taking me out of a movie. And this one did that frequently. So there's just too many visual issues. Again, there are some good things about it, but they're very few and far between. I'm just not the biggest fan of this movie, and it's compounded because... They're trying to launch a franchise here. And that's about as good as a dovetail as I'm going to get into talking about the money in some respects, because I need to do that. Where is my music? Here it is. Okay. So again, there's my sequence. Here we go.
Here comes the money.
Here we go.
Money talk.
All right. This thing had a production budget of $175 million. I'm going to let that sink in for a minute. Now, again, normally this is insane, especially for a somewhat untested property. Again, the Arthurian legend has box office history behind it in some respects, it's been, I mean, even, again, the most recent incarnation from a cinematic standpoint, I know there have been a few like made for television stuff. The BBC has a Merlin series that I've heard is quite good. I haven't seen it myself yet. But I mean, even again, the most recent movie was in 2004, and that was only moderately successful. I'd have to double check whether or not it actually lost money, but at best it was like a break-even prospect. The budget here was inflated due to this movie, I think, came about during the change in executive management at Warner Brothers Studios, which always, whenever that happens, anything that's in production is going to get reworked, rethought, and all that money just goes right down the toilet, unless you just soldier ahead with it. And this was rewritten. This had different people writing it who had different visions. They had extensive reshoots, I recall hearing. After some of the early test audiences for the movie didn't pan out, they reshot sequences. To their credit, I couldn't quite pick them out. I mean, this wasn't as bad as, the Four-Stick movie, where it's really obvious when poor Kate Mara got pulled back in, like, because when she was filming originally, she dyed her hair blonde. Okay, we need to do extensive reshoots because, well, you can listen to Mark and I talk about that movie. And they just threw, she had, just wears a blonde wig for that. And again, really obvious. All that costs money. This is the same. You'd think this studio would have learned its lesson as far as this goes, because this is the same studio that produced Pan a few years ago, which had a grossly bloated budget of something like right around $200 million, I seem to recall. And for the life of me, I still have no idea what they spent it on. I mean, they must have just, like, shot almost an entire movie, thrown it away, and shot a second one. Because, again, I Mark and I reviewing Pan is in the archives here as well, so feel free to go back and listen to us talk about that one. But this is essentially a very similar story, because Pan was trying to launch a franchise, and I said at the time that I got the feeling with a lot of the writing of that movie that, you know, here's all these problems. And I felt like every time the writers brought that up, someone, either another writer, an executive, somebody just said, we'll fix it in the sequel. And, well, you're only going to get a sequel if you're successful. And Pan wasn't. And in this instance, again, there's a lot that goes a little bit unanswered. They completely exclude the character of Merlin, which I'm not beholden to the source material. If you want to play with it, that's fine and dandy. Play with it. The Legend of Arthur has been altered many, many times successfully. So you can play with it, but you eschewed a major character completely. There's a lot left unanswered about the nature of magic, the relationship between those who can use magic and those who can't. A significant portion of the motivation or the actions taken by Vortigern is building a magic tower that gives him power, theoretically. And it's never explained why, if that was a condition of the power he received, if he came across this on his own. It was briefly mentioned that he and Mordred had a bit of an alliance, and that's what spawned Mordred's attack, but it gets kind of glossed over during an exposition dump rather than actually explored. And I can't help but feel like during, you know, portions of this writing, we're trying to leave stuff for the sequel. And I can't express enough how much I hate that mentality. Just make the best movie you can, and if you get a sequel, fine and dandy, but planning for it from an artistic perspective is just, it constantly misfires. Anyway, so apart from the bloated budget of $175 million, this thing opened number three very badly. Number one, domestically, okay, these are all domestic numbers, I believe. Number one, Guardians of the Galaxy. Volume 2, to the shock of no one, pulled in another $63 million. It's got a domestic total of $246 million. I think its worldwide total is now over $600 million as of, you know, this moment. Double-check that. It is $636 million worldwide. It took over the number three spot from Logan. It's now behind only Fate of the Furious and Beauty and the Beast. And will probably make a billion, and Mark and I have said it'll make $1 billion by the time it wraps up its theatrical run. Again, opening at number two, another soft opening. You had Snatched, Goldie Hawn and Amy Schumer comedy. There's heavy air quotes around comedy there, which only pulled in $17.5 million. I think it was predicted low 20s, so this is well below expectation. Then we get to King Arthur, which opened at $14.7 million. Yeah, not good. And that's domestic, so it's worldwide is just $46.2 million as of today. Yeah, this thing's flopping hard. I mean, there's no way they're going to make that $300 million. No, $350 million they'd need on that budget. Oh yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, this studio not only did Pan, they did The Legend of Tarzan from last year, which all kinds of issues. And I did not know this. They did Jack the Giant Slayer years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, and which was a significant flop financially. Universal just cannot seem to buy. was this Universal? No, Warner Brothers, sorry. Warner Brothers just can't seem to buy a franchise that they can manufacture outside of desperately hoping that Justice League doesn't flop. Rounding out for the rest of the top 10 for the week, we had Fate of the Furious pulled in another $5.3 million at number 4. The Boss Baby keeps chugging along, pulled in another $4.6 million. Beauty and the Beast pulled in another $3.9 million. Beauty and the Beast still the highest grossing movie of the year so far at $1.207 billion. Okay. Now Fate of the Furious at $1.193 billion. So they're pretty close. They're only $14 million apart. I don't know if Fate will overtake it, but they're pretty close. How to Be a Latin Lover keeps chugging along, pulled in $3.8 million. Some lower ones, you had Lowrider, which I've heard nothing about, pulled in $2.4 million. The Circle, which also kind of bombed, I seem to recall, at number 9 at $1.7 million. And rounding out the top 10, I cannot pronounce this movie. Bahubali? I'm going with Bahubali 2, The Conclusion, which pulled in $1.6 million. And yeah, again, this was Guardians all the way, uncontested, and we'll probably be there next week. There's the only thing, the big opening next week is Ridley Scott's Alien Covenant, which has been getting, the reviews have been a little bit mixed. I've heard good things, I've heard, you know, less than good things, so. Guardians will likely keep on chugging. King Arthur it's going to fall hard. Worldwide, because you know Mark usually does this. So our worldwide top 10 for the year: Beauty and the Beast, Fate of the Furious, Guardians of the Galaxy, Logan, Kong Skull Island, Boss Baby, 50 Shades Darker, God help us, XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, God damn us. The Lego Batman movie, what are we doing, people? And Split. Those last, like, four are lower than $400 million. There's a lot that's going to shake this list up as time goes on, but that's where we stand at the moment. Arthur this is a bomb. This is going to bomb hard. And Warner Brothers is, again, they're banking real hard on Wonder Woman and Justice League. That's their significant entries this year. I mean, they had a surprise hit with Skull Island, which, again, number 5 right now, $564 million. But other than that, they're in the weeds a little bit. All right, that's going to do it for the money, which means this is going to be interesting. I'm going to have to do this solo this time around. And I'm not sure how this is going to go. But I will be Again, anyway, we all know kind of what time this is. There we are. There's my button. I haven't navigated extensively Rotten Tomatoes in a while, but it's time for me to yell at critics, and I really don't want to. Do I have to do this? Please don't make me do this.
No, God! No, God, please, no! 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 No!
Okay, here we go. Let's start with, I don't know how Mark does this. I'm going to have to get a more detailed scenario from him as, you know, again, the specifics of how this works. I'm only looking at top critics at the moment. Let's start with, okay, I'm only finding the fresh reviews here because, again, I can't understand how you arrived at this being a good movie. Again, there are good elements to it, but. We have Teddy Waldman, who writes for Slate, again, top critic. Richie has gleefully set his time-worn characters in an environment where narrative logic has no purchase. One name for this environment is Subconscious Dreamscape, another is Mosh Pit. I'm not sure how this arrived, how that particular reviewer arrived at a fresh review given that particular clip, but I mean, that's essentially accurate. I forgot the best part about this movie. I need to get this out there. The music. I can't believe I forgot this for this long. There's a really nice score to this movie. Best part about this movie is the soundtrack. Take that however you'd like to, again, positive or negative, but I dug the score. Let's see here. Richie uses a rollicking soundtrack, which I agreed with, and wild visual flourishes is off his rocker here, enough so that he makes a familiar, stale tale seem fresh. See, this is ridiculous. I agree this movie is a little bit out there. The notion that he has somehow taken the Arthur legend and made it and given you a new flair, a new take on it that seems, you know, engaging. I mean, there have been a multitude. Have you just never seen other adaptations of this work? Because they exist. Not all of them are set even in medieval times. There's actually some interesting adaptations that, you know, set this either in the contemporary or in the future, chronologically. That's. I'd also fundamentally object to the notion that the Arthur legend is a stale one, because there's so much room for improvisation. Again, it. The Arthur legend is kind of like Shakespeare in the sense that the narrative structure, I mean, Shakespeare, the language is more important in many respects, but the actual, like, chronological setting is completely secondary to so much of what makes the story successful. And I don't think that's my, I think the biggest flaw in this movie is that Richie has just kind of couched a generic London street crime drama in this other, in the garb of an Arthur story, and the marriage just doesn't work. That one was from Adam Graham of the Detroit News. I almost can't feel bad for him. He lives in Detroit. I assume he does if he writes for them, at least, and, you know, Mad Max times up there. We have James Berardinelli of Real Views. Again, I'm only looking at top critics at the moment. Kinetic and attention-grabbing. I imagine if that's the highlight that you took away from this movie, you did sleep through significant portions of it. Again, there's scenes in London specifically that have the typical Richie kinetic pace to them and works quite well. Everything else, not nearly so much. It's stilted. It's emotionally underwhelming, and there's almost nothing to the character interactions. I agree with that one. Okay, this one from Mark Jenkins of NPR. I'm reading this because I found it mildly amusing. While making a hash of a national legend, Richie is at least enough of a patriot to have filmed King Arthur entirely in the UK. I mean, I'm sure the tax breaks provided by filming in different parts of England had nothing to do with it. And again, I fundamentally disagree that he, again, much as I disagree that he made it contemporary and engaging, I don't necessarily agree with the fact that he's, you know, hashing it. He's reimagining it. And again, there's failures within that reimagination. There's failures of execution. There's failures of budgeting and planning and all that stuff. But the basic story of Arthur is not, again, it's not written in stone. It's not dogma. You can play with it. You should play with it deliberately rather than just throwing names around, which is kind of what this felt like at times. I mean, hey, we'll take Mordred and turn him into a sorcerer with no spoken dialogue. Really? This is the decision you arrived at? Richard Roper. Jeez. I almost hate to bash the guy, because I don't always agree with him, but King Arthur works best when the focus is on the bonds forged between Arthur and his future knights, the battles between the rebel forces and the obligatory faceless henchmen, and even the slightly sexual tension. See, again, none of that seemed like it was really effective. The relationship between Arthur and his future knights was one of the biggest letdowns, because you have good enough actors in those roles, but the writing just fails them miserably. The battles, again, were overly complicated CGI messes that were difficult to distinguish visually. And the sexual tension was basically non-existent and utterly unnecessary. Okay, here's one that I disagree with. Matthew Lacona of the San Diego Reader. Jude Law almost manages to chew his way through the CGI scenery and create a gloriously wicked villain, but in the end, even he succumbs to the dumb. Well, almost all villains succumb to the dumb. I can't believe you actually wrote that. Like, how are you proud of that particular sentence the way you did? I didn't find that Jude Law was chewing scenery. I mean, it might have been more entertaining if he did in some respects, but, and again, the fact that you take what could have been a victim, a villain who, if I can quote Mr. Burns, so to speak, revels in his own crapulence, and you give him individual moments where he clearly has things and people that he cares deeply about, and that he's, you know, I mean, if he had no heart when sacrificing these people to obtain power, that's different. That is completely different, and I would agree with that. But he does, it makes him a little more human, and I'm fine with villains that are human and interesting and three-dimensional, but he doesn't ever actually achieve that. He's two-dimensional with like a few bumps. And again, I don't agree that Jude Law was chewing scenery here. Let's see. Clever phrasing, but utterly pointless. Okay, here's one. Andrea Gronvall, the Chicago Reader. After directing a number of British crime comedies, Guy Ritchie applied his rapid-fire wisecracks, gleeful violence, and flashy cutting and camera moves to Sherlock Holmes franchise. And the same method works well for this big-budget Arthurian legend. See, that final bit is where we run into a problem. The same method doesn't work well for this. Again, the most successful points of this movie are the ones that have the least to do with the Arthur legend. And really, if Guy Ritchie had just made, again, a crime comedy slash action movie set in, you know, more medieval London, and we just eschewed the trappings of the Arthur legend, he could have focused specifically on what he does well, and we might have got a better, completely unique movie. Yeah, but such is not the state of Hollywood. Again, just anytime they're not in a big city doing big city things, this movie suffers. That's why it worked in Sherlock Holmes. That's why the elements of the second Sherlock Holmes movie that suffer so much tend to be the parts where they're traveling or, you know, not in a major city. Or, you know, where they don't get to rely on subtlety. And it's, again. See, this one I disagree with. From Colin Covert of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Relentlessly incoherent, more a gaudy, tacky, British-themed pinball machine than a carefully coordinated movie. See, at this point, I just question whether or not you've seen a Guy Ritchie movie. I mean, this is Ritchie's style. He's very much all over the place. There's a lot of cuts, a lot of fast talk. and a lot of stuff that you have to actually pay attention to keep up with. This movie is not incoherent in the sense that you don't understand what's going on. There are elements that are not explained properly, but those are not necessarily even introduced as points that you feel should be explained. It's almost more like they should have just been written out, rather than contributing in a negative sense. This is not an incoherent movie. There are issues, but it's relatively easy to follow, I thought. Okay. Oh, geez. All right. Michael O'Sullivan of the Washington Post. King Arthur Legend of the Sword is a fun, if sacrilegious, first step in a franchise creation, one that observes the first commandment of storytelling, thou shalt not be boring. Okay. First of all, this thing is not creating a franchise, all right? Again, the money alone dictates that. And maybe you're a critic who doesn't actually pay attention to such things. But it's a significant part of the film industry at this point. So, no. Second, first of all, sacrilegious. Again, none of this feels sacrilegious. They're not skewering the legend. They're just reimagining it. That is not at all the same thing. Not at all. Taking, you know, recouching a legend, a familiar story in a slightly different setting and tweaking characters and relationships, that's not sacrilegious in almost any way. I mean, that's... So you're wrong here. I mean, there's a much better word than sacrilegious to make your point. You know, unconventional. And I'm going to disagree with you about thou shalt not be boring. I'm going to be... Okay, first of all, what bores you and what doesn't bore you is subjective, right? What bores some people doesn't bore me. What entertains me bores other people. For an MMA reference, there's a significant... There's a portion of the MMA fandom that finds Joanna and Jacek's fights boring. There's a significant portion that find Demetrius Johnson boring. These are the same people who praise crappy heavyweight fights, usually. That's what entertains them, and that's fine. I'm not here to, you know, what entertains you is what entertains you, but please let's not pretend that there's a hard line in the sand here. There are trends, but there is no dogmatic this. There are boring stretches of this movie. Let's be very clear about that. There's a lot of time wasted in some areas. Again, there are boring stretches of this movie. There's some that are very frantic and therefore grab your attention, and there's some that are engaging. But the notion that, no, this is not a boring movie, I mean, it imposes your own sensibilities onto a wider audience. There are parts of this movie that I found boring. So, again, you're just... Why can't you... There's so many better ways to phrase these things that make you seem like a rational, intelligent human being who knows what he's talking about. But, sadly, those don't usually fit in 140 characters and therefore get by the wayside. Yay, contemporary society. I disagree with this one. Stephanie, going with Zacharek, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name, from Time Magazine, it's all more wearying than fun. All right, let me say again, fun, much like entertainment, subjective, not objective. I disagree with wearying. I mean, again, issues, certainly. A few parts that are a little bit boring. Yeah, sure. But this movie at least ends on the right note in the sense that it ends with action, which is what people are seeing this for. And again, there are fun parts to this movie. I'm not sure that's an accurate assessment. Okay, this one I agree with, mind you. This is why I'm reading it. Carrie Darling of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram /DFW.com. I apologize for whatever that is. There's little here but the naked desire to forcibly will a new fantasy franchise into being. There's a lot of truth there. There's a few things that, again, there is good to this movie. There are good visuals, usually when they're not involving CGI. There's some good acting, but... Yeah, again, they're Warner Brothers trying so hard to just franchise whatever they have. Let's see. Again, we got one here that says Dave Calhoun of Time Out. It's patchy and chaotic, but also an energetic spectacle. Again, patchy and chaotic is somewhat accurate. You know, and that, again, that applies to a lot of Guy Ritchie films in many respects. I disagree with energetic. There's a lot of downtime in this movie. And maybe you just blocked it from your mind, which is fine, but it exists. And again, there is energy in places, but a lot of this is not so much. Okay, this one I agree with. Well, sort of. Okay, I gotta take this one on. Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. I'm no businessman, but plans for a 6-film franchise may be optimistic. Covered that. Optimistic might be the wrong word. Delusional might be a little bit better. This is where I take issue. Optimism is nowhere to be found in Ritchie's movie itself. See, that I disagree with. There's an undertone here of that delves into politics and, you know, the oppressed people rising up. That's, again, part of the story they're telling in this instance. And, I mean, maybe you think for it to be optimistic, you know, there's no sacrifice by the good guys, and Arthur heroically accepts his destiny at first opportunity and so on and so forth. But there's a significant what should have been, let me rephrase that. There's what should have been a significant point part of this movie that is Arthur not wanting to be king. That's not what he wants out of life. In fact, he first takes up trying to kill Vortigern just for revenge. He says so. I mean, again, actual dialogue. And so him arriving at the decision that, you know, making a different choice for the greater good, I find that optimistic, personally. Again, his journey there is dark at times, but there's no optimism in this film is... I'm not sure I agree with that. It's harder to find, but it's there. I think that's where we're going to end it on that note, as far as the critics go. I've got to get Mark's list of guys that he usually brings up, in case I have to fly solo again. But yeah, okay, that's gonna go ahead and wrap this up. I'm not necessarily going to recommend this movie. I mean, if you have a dollar theater or, you know, other discount theater, I wouldn't pay for the 3D. I don't know why they did this. It was utterly unnecessary. The 3D kind of conversion or addition seems like a cash grab in a lot of respects. So I wouldn't do that, but, you know, on a budget or when it winds up on Netflix, if you're a fan of Ritchie, you might enjoy elements of it. If you're a fan of Arthurian lore, there's some interesting takes here. I mean, some good, some bad, but interesting. And, you know, in some respects, anyway, if you're an academic on the subject, for example, you know, consume it, analyze it, and so forth. But just not a terribly good film. Again, and with its history, again, the production issues, it's actually kind of a miracle it's as watchable as it is. And again, how watchable? Varies taste to taste. But I mean, I actually don't think it's quite as much of a mess as Pan was. So, I mean, take that how you will. All right. Again, that's going to be it for me tonight. Mark and I will be back next week, hopefully. Get well soon, Mark. We'll be reviewing Alien Covenant, which, again, little mixed reviews, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. I may feel differently after the fact, but I am looking forward to actually seeing the movie, so we'll see how that goes. I did read a review. I think this was Jeff Harris again. That says that spoiled a bit about James Franco dying before he can utter a line of dialogue. I'm all in. That's worth my $5 right there. Watching James Franco burn to death in a cryo tube without speaking is going to be worth the $5 for me. Not a fan of James Franco. So, in fact, he has actively pushed me away from properties I might have otherwise been interested in. Anyway, my personal taste aside. even if that's the only good thing I have to say about the movie, I will not consider that a waste of the ticket price. So we'll be back next week for that. Again, hope Mark feels better by then. Thanks to everyone in over at 411 Mania who followed along with my live coverage of UFC 112. I'm back on the 28th for UFC Fight Night 109. That's a rough one, guys. That is a rough one. The top two fights are light heavyweights. The main event's all right. It's Alexander Gustafsson and Glover Teixeira. Co-main is Misha Cirkunov and Volkan Uzdemir. So hopefully Cirkunov finally gets into the top five after beating top five heavyweight light heavyweight Volkan Uzdemir. One fight in the UFC. One split decision win. Ugh. That division sucks. It just sucks. So we're off until then. The last edition of the 411 Ground and Pound radio show is up in the archives. Feel free to listen to that. A few minor technical difficulties aside, fortunately it didn't open with a bunch of dead air, which was my legitimate fear. Like, the show started 10 minutes late because my internet died. My phone is connected to my internet service, so when that craps out, it all goes down. Thanks, Comcast. And a few of Blog Talk's eccentricities played into that. So, but fortunately, it does just pick up when we got going. So there's a few minor glitches along the way because it was one of those nights. But again, you can feel free to listen to that where we review UFC 211. Did I say 112 earlier? I probably did. 211. I didn't cover UFC 1. Did I cover UFC 112? Now I have to double check that. But anyway, 211. From Saturday. Good card. So thanks to everybody for that. And again, hopefully Mark and I will be back next week. Until then, thank you also very much for listening. You're much appreciated. Please continue to be well, be safe, and behave.